Hi, this is Catherine Elsden. I'm the minister at Bethel Maidstone United Church, located in Maidstone, Ontario. This weekly podcast is a way to deepen your spiritual life and connect with our community. This episode is our final in a conversational series, speaking with people working on the front lines of this pandemic to hear their reflections on faith, hope, and resiliency. Today, I speak with Lorna Baker, a funeral director. I know what you're thinking. This is going to be depressing. Very few people like to talk about death or think about it. We do a very bad job in our society of nurturing healthy conversations about death and grief. We mostly try to just avoid it. And to be honest, I'm not sure that's working out so well for us. Jesus had a very different relationship to issues of life and death. We think of the story of how he restored life to a man named Lazarus in John chapter 11. Lazarus was a dear friend, brother to Mary and Martha. Upon learning of his death and seeing the grief of Lazarus's friends and family, Jesus is greatly disturbed and openly weeps. He goes to the tomb of Lazarus, prays, and calls in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out!" Lazarus walks out of the tomb, still bound in strips of cloth. By this and many other works, including his own death and resurrection, Jesus demonstrates God's power over life and death. Grief and death trouble Jesus, clearly, but he also sees death as something to be faced head-on, something to be navigated with faith and hope. In God's kingdom, life and love do not end with death. The encounters Jesus has with death, in the end, actually affirm life and the life-giving power of God's love. In this episode, I have a conversation with a funeral director, someone who daily confronts the realities of death. We sometimes stereotype funeral directors as severe, somber, or intimidating. But in my experience, I found the opposite to be true. They're more often caring, funny, interesting people with a lot to say about life and death and how to get it right. In this conversation, you'll hear Lorna talk about navigating grief, about what makes for a good funeral and a good life, as well as the importance of faith. Let us pray. O living God of past and future, we praise you for this present moment. Fill us with your joy and empower us with your Holy Spirit, that our strength may be renewed to sing a new song of your glory in a world which longs for your justice and peace. All this we ask in the name of Jesus, in whom we become your new creation. Amen. Hi, Lorna. Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, hi, Catherine. Nice to talk to you today.
Yeah, it's great to have you. First question, which is a complicated one in these pandemic times. How are you doing?
I think I'm doing well. It's, now that we've got this far, I feel pretty good. We're in a good place. I think at the beginning, everyone was a little nervous, but no, I'm doing very well at this time.
Good. Maybe you could start by telling all of us your full name, where you work, your credentials, and how long you've worked in this business.
Okay. My name is Lorna Baker. I was licensed in 1995 as a funeral director. So I've been in this business for 26 years. I did work for a couple of years just working at a funeral home while I was in school. But I've been in my hometown. So I worked in Toronto for 9 years, and now I've been in my hometown since 2001. So managing the funeral home, and my husband is one of the owners. So managing the funeral home in Essex for now 20 years. Yeah, so it's it goes quick.
So, yeah, and that's Reed Funeral Home in Essex.
Oh, Reed Funeral Home in Essex. Yes, you're right.
Well, I wanted to start with a disclaimer that this is not, in fact, a paid endorsement. But I enjoy working with both funeral homes in Essex. But you actually did inspire this series for the podcast because I missed our car ride conversations. Typically, at funerals, the funeral director often, you know, offers me a ride between the funeral home or the church and the cemetery. And those car rides, I just love kind of picking your brain and hearing all about the work that you do and getting your perspective. So I thought it would be so interesting to hear from you and other frontline essential workers on your perspective on hope and resiliency during these pandemic times. So thanks for the inspiration.
Thank you. Yeah. And I've missed our car ride chats as well, because it is for safety that you can't ride with us anymore, but it's definitely a way that we catch up. So I've missed them too. Yeah. So thanks for asking.
Maybe you could tell me how it is that you got into funeral direction in the first place.
So I was in school, just at the end of high school. My parents, and I think a lot of parents try to do this, but they just made me go to university actually. So I didn't know what to take, and I was good in sciences and math. And so I just went and started to take sciences at university. And after my first year, my aunt and uncle were in Florida, and I decided to go there just to study for exams before my finals. And I thought, oh, I'll just go there, just how nice to study by the pool. And so I went there to visit with them. And my very first day, I was there for a week. My first day, I sat beside the pool and I was just studying. And I had a bunch of books beside me, and a lady that sat beside me, I still remember her name was Millie. And she was probably in her mid to late 70s. And she just started to talk to me and figured I was a student, talked to me about what I was studying. And I talked to her for quite a while that day. And then she said to me, "You should become a funeral director." And I said, oh, like it hadn't even crossed my mind. And she said, "My husband owns funeral homes in New York, and it's a male-based occupation, but," she said, "it is really a job where you need to be able to talk to people." And she said, "You have the gift of that." And so she said, you, "I think you would put people at ease." And, so I thought, oh yeah, wow. Okay. And it was kind of, science, I thought science-based, but she said, yeah, it is science, the physical part of it. But so I went home and I said to my mom and dad, being I was 18 or 19, and I said, I'm going to check into funeral service. Well, I think they thought it was a phase. So
a morbid phase or something.
Yeah, I think my dad said, well, if I didn't finish university, I needed to finish university first, because it wasn't just something that I could study on a whim. So he said, get your degree. And if at the end of your degree, you still want to do it, then we'll help you do that. And I did. So at the end of my degree, I decided and then I started to work part time at the funeral home at Reed's in Essex. And I decided that I liked it. And here I am all those years later. Yeah. So that was in 1990. I went to Florida. Yeah. So that's like 31 years ago.
Wow. Isn't that incredible? A conversation with a stranger opened your eyes to a new opportunity.
It did. Yeah. Yeah. It's just a little bit of, I guess my path was supposed to cross with hers. Yeah. Weird.
Well, as Millie said, that was over 26 years ago, right?
Yes. Yeah.
As she said, that the industry was very much male dominated at the time. I think you could maybe still say that. Tell me about what that was like for you as a woman coming into the industry.
Yeah, it was difficult, I would say, just because a young girl, and now you're dealing with the stereotype is, a somber, middle-aged to older men that looked at me as if I couldn't handle the position. So I wasn't physically as strong as them because the job does entail some lifting. And, you know, if you have to go to a hospital and bring someone into your care and they're a larger person, they looked at me that I couldn't handle that. Was I able to? And now I was in Toronto when I started there, so I didn't know a lot about the city. So they weren't welcoming, I would say, initially. But I think as a woman, you just maybe have to fight a little harder to prove yourself. But once they realize that you are there to stay and, you know, that you were comfortable in the position. And then I think men now have started to see that women's place in this industry, not that we're more caring, but we're a little bit able to, or more able to maybe give a hug or whereas a man, if they just went up to hug someone, it's not maybe as welcoming. But I hug, not in COVID times, obviously, but I'm a hugger, or a, you know, I'm just a person that will, you know, I'm easy to talk to, I would say. So yeah, that they, I got a lot more respect, but it took some time.
Mm-hmm. And now I'm seeing more and more young women coming into the field.
Yes. And I'd say that is now, I mean, now there's options to, you know, for lifting, and there's different equipment you can use. It's not as old school as it was before, but I think it's now the industry is changing into becoming more of a caregiver role instead of just the physical part of the embalming and the lifting and bringing someone, like transfers, or, you know, they're looking at it as more of a job of care.
Well, things have certainly changed over the decades you've spent in this business, and particularly over the last year. In what ways has the pandemic impacted your work?
I would say, well, we have new rules almost weekly, so that's probably been a big change for us. We normally are under our what's called the BAO, the Bereavement Authority of Ontario, and they are our guidelines day to day, and we follow those, and those guidelines are in place, and every funeral home follows them. But with funeral homes having to follow the provincial restrictions, obviously we follow those, but then the Bereavement Authority of Ontario has also put in even more strict regulations. So I just found that it was difficult for us to balance what we were trying to do for families and follow all of the restrictions. So that was probably a big thing. We were lucky in our area. We never really had any illnesses. Nothing has been traced back for funerals in regards to COVID. But, you know, we took many steps to keep everyone safe. We divided our staff into two teams. So we, where the two teams would not cross paths, because if one team got sick, or if your funeral home staff got sick, the funeral home would be shut down for 14 days just to make sure that nothing, you know, was passed to the community. But we were able to divide our staff into two teams, which then made it safe for, you know, if one team got infected, then the other team would have to work to 2 weeks. So we changed our shift. We've changed our staff. We've changed, you know, everything we do day to day. It's been difficult when we have to have families already have arrangements in place. If they make the arrangements on a Monday and new restrictions come out on a Thursday and they now have to change for the Friday, that's been difficult. But you know, families are really understanding, and they know, and we tell them ahead of time, you know, we may have to change, but everyone's been really good. So that's probably the biggest difficulty.
Yeah. So many impacts on every level of your work, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah, it has. Yeah.
As a funeral director, what are some of the concerns or particular challenges in this third wave of the pandemic, would you say?
I would say now people are a little more frustrated. So they're adhering less to the restrictions, which then we have to work harder to make people stick to it. So it's, they're a little less attentive, but yet respectful and understanding when we do have to push it. For example, you know, it's also, well, I was going to say, for example, when a young person passes away, it's hard for just family to say goodbye. So we have to let people be able to have friends say goodbye. And you know, to make that time for everyone to say goodbye is difficult.
In that deep grief of a friend dying, you know, this sometimes might seem like a secondary priority to follow the COVID regulations.
Absolutely. Yeah. They just think that, I mean, you know, this is my buddy. Why can't I say goodbye? Or this is my cousin, or this is my nephew. Or, and I say, I'm sorry, you're not in the core group. You know, it's hard to say that to someone because sometimes friends are closer than family. So it's hard to make that differential between people. So yeah, it's been, that's probably the hardest part.
And currently right now, I know the restriction is 10 people total at a funeral.
Yes. Yeah. So that's difficult. So what we've been doing is making the appointments. So you are able to schedule appointments and then it's only 10 people in the building at one time. So if you had two family members that are going to be the group that stays in the room, and then 8 people are allowed in. So you have to book accordingly. So we have booking systems on our websites now that we've never had before, you know, but elderly people don't necessarily know how to do that, or people that aren't tech friendly. So we get lots of calls. There's lots of scheduling. Our whole world has kind of changed in regards to who can come to the funeral and how they do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the midst of all of that, all of those changes, has there been anything that surprised you as you've worked through this roller coaster year?
Yeah, I would say that although we as funeral directors have many more steps to put in place with scheduling and trying to keep everyone in place and within our restriction, we've had people ask or mention that they like the appointment scheduling. So instead of, you know, traditionally you would have had to come to the funeral home and wait in line. If it was a young person and there was going to be 300 people, you would just come and wait in line till you were able to get to the family. Now, you know, people have said they like the appointment scheduling and hope that that can continue in the future. So that's one thing that we've actually been shocked about. And another, I guess, maybe not a shock or surprise, but a positive thought movement is because people are movement towards people having funerals. So where I think people thought with COVID, less people would have funerals because of restrictions and fear of being around others, it's actually moved somewhat in the opposite direction for us because what we've sensed is that people are now not being able to say goodbye in hospitals, or they're speaking to their loved one through an iPad. Now they need that closure. They need that funeral because they haven't journeyed with someone through an illness. They now really see the importance of a funeral. So, you know, that's been a positive movement towards funerals and a bit of a surprise for us too.
Well, yes. Over the years, I think as a minister, I've certainly perceived it, I'm sure you even more so, that there have been changes in the way that people celebrate the life of a loved one who's died. So I wonder if you could talk to me about, you know, funeral trends over the years.
Yeah, I would say definitely a movement towards cremation is a large trend. And there's also a movement, I guess, towards not having traditional funerals. So I guess what would have been the unusual in the past is now becoming the usual. Like what we would have considered unusual is now, you know, considered usual, or, you know, anything goes kind of is the way. So, you know, cremation, yes, definite increase in that, but now people are personalizing their funerals in different ways. There is, people have funerals in many different places now, whether it's golf courses or a pub or their backyard or, you know, at a beach. They, you know, it doesn't have to be as traditional as it was in the past. But I think, and my hope is, and I think it is, they still see the value in the ritual of the funeral. So they, you know, we hope that that will continue. That is my livelihood, but I think it's important. But it is the trend that people are thinking they can do their own thing, because people are more educated now with funerals as well, you know, so they come in thinking they know what they want. But I would say a mistake too in the trend is that people tend to do what they think the deceased person wanted, not necessarily what the deceased person wanted and what the family needs. So sometimes, you know, if I'm talking about my own funeral and I say, I don't need a funeral, just put me, you know, bury me in the backyard, for example, you hear a lot of people joke about that. And then when the family comes in, they'll say, oh, he didn't want a funeral. You know, this was something that was his wish. But then those families are the ones that struggle the most. So they tend to, we see that in funerals, you know, they'll be the ones that come into the funeral home many times after for just different things. And I can tell that it's more about support because they just haven't got that support. If it were my funeral, I would just want my family to do whatever they needed to do. So, and people.
Right. In many ways, the funerals for those who have survived the deceased.
That's right.
Help them to come to terms with it and to say goodbye.
That's right. But the trend now is today, I need to do what my deceased person wanted me to do instead of what you need to do.
That's interesting. That actually leads into the next question I have for you. From your perspective, are there key elements that make for a meaningful funeral service?
Oh yeah, I would say personalization. So personalization is the big thing. And just doing something. So again, where I said that funerals are, or the trend is changing, you don't necessarily have to have the funeral in a funeral home or in a church. But you just, to me, you have to do something. So when I think of a funeral, you know, whether I attended in someone's backyard at a barbecue or in a church or in the funeral home, I want to learn something about that person's funeral or learn something about the person that I didn't know before. So whether it's through a eulogy, you know, I think learning about someone and what their passions were and what their loves were, that makes for a meaningful funeral for me.
Do you have any insights or reflections on coping with grief and the death of a loved one?
You have to lean on those that are there for you. So that, I mean, it seems like it's common sense, but a lot of people try and keep their grief inside, thinking that if I don't face it, I don't have to deal with it. But I think you really need to lean on those that are there for you. There's also, there's so many groups that are available and support groups, whether it's churches or friends or elderly groups that you can get involved with. I think you just need to face your grief because it's not something that you ever get over. You have to learn to live in a different way. And I think that takes time to get an understanding of that. And I think families don't necessarily realize that it's not just a process. And once I'm at the end of it, it's over. No, it's a life journey that, it's a definite thing that changes your life.
And it sounds like that process begins in part by taking the time to mark the death, right? That the
absolutely
is the beginning of acknowledging it and journeying towards healing.
Absolutely. Yeah, agree.
When done well, I think your job is more than a job. It's a vocation. I think there are common stereotypes about funeral directors and the work that you do. From my experience, funeral ministry can be sad, but it's also very, very meaningful work. So I wondered if you could comment on misconceptions about your work and about funeral directors in general.
I guess there's been some negative media in regards to funerals per se in the last 10 or 15 years, I think, which is leading people to think less of a funeral or less of tradition. I mean, funeral homes have to make money, but I would say the biggest misconception is that that's all we're in this job for. That is absolutely not true. You wouldn't find any funeral. I mean, when this funeral or this position takes a lot out of you, I think it really does. And it, just as ministry would, as you say, I get a lot of positive feedback because we live in a nice small community. But I think we're almost in similar to ministry. I think this is almost a calling. Like you can't do this job if you're not meant to do it. And I think that's a misconception that people think we're just in it and we make lots of money and we drive nice cars. And that's not necessarily true. Yeah, I'd say that's the biggest.
What else? The other thing I've observed is that there's kind of that stereotype of the solemn, right, imposing figure of a funeral director. And most funeral directors I know are actually very fun, like, you know, energetic.
We have a good sense of humor, usually. We have a really pretty good sense of humor. And that's how we have to get through day to day, right? We have to make, not that we make light of death, but we have to find a way to get through our days, you know, and we look at life in a different way. I think we need to appreciate, and we, you know, when we see lives that are too short or we have to, we see the value of living. So we try and do our best to make that what we focus on.
So are you telling me that like funeral directors, when you meet up at conferences, it's just a wild party or?
Kind of. It can be. No, you get, and you get a lot of different, some funeral directors that are hard to understand their humor, but you know, when you're in the business, I guess you get it, but no, yeah, it can be pretty, pretty fun at times. We make it.
Well, you do have a privileged insight, I think, and perspective on life and death. And yes. You're, as you mentioned, your job could just take such a toll. I've seen you cry more than once at funerals. And, you know, how do you cope with the stress of your job?
I guess, well, in my life in particular, I'm lucky that I have a husband who is also a funeral director. So I lean on him. I know, I mean, we understand each other and what our day-to-day is, and he'll reach out to me knowing if it's a more difficult funeral than, you know, one day than another. So that is probably one way I relieve stress. Yeah, we lean on our friends, our family. I have really good support around me. And I think as an industry as well, we've now recognized that I wouldn't say it's post-traumatic stress, but you know, some funerals stay with us. So we're family, like I remember many families that I've served, and I'm lucky in our small community that I have made so many connections, and we make these connections, but then I see these families on a day-to-day basis, or whether it's in the grocery store or out for a walk. And every time I see them, it can take me back to their funeral, just the same as I'm sure when people see me, it can take them back to their funeral. But I think just, you know, so in our industry, what I was going to say is in our industry, I think we've recognized that. And so there's support. We get more support from our colleagues around us now just to lean on them as well.
Mm-hmm. And you don't want it to become a situation in which the work no longer impacts you on a personal level, right? I'm sure you want to care and you want to be.
Right. Present, yeah.
And I think you also have makes to protect yourself.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I think that's what makes a good funeral director, you know, the difference between a good funeral maybe and a great funeral director could be the caring level, you know, and I would say most funeral directors have that, you know, we kind of all, because we wouldn't do this job if we didn't care. Yeah.
Are there things about funerals in general, it could be funeral preparation, that you wish people knew or better understood?
Maybe that really we can try and do whatever we want for them. People come in and think we're trying to lead them in a certain direction. That's definitely not the case. We want to personalize a funeral as much as we can for them. I would say it's more leading up to the funeral or preparing for your funeral. So there's still many people that come into the funeral home that don't have wills. So when there's a death and there's no will, it makes it very complicated for them. They may be worried about finances because they don't know who's in charge. Now the money is frozen. People become very stressed and distracted by the finances of a funeral because nothing is in place. So I would say I wish people understood more the difficulty of not preparing for your funeral can be. So whether it's, you know, even pre-planning a funeral, you can pre-plan a funeral without prepaying. So you don't have to, people think that when you're going to plan for your funeral, you have to pay. You don't. So even pre-planning is a big step. I would say that's a definite positive step, but people don't understand that they don't have to pay. So if they understood that and understood the necessity of a will and estate planning and just the family dynamics, you know, people think that I'll just leave it to my kids, but when your kids don't get along, then you're creating havoc for the funeral process.
Yeah, it can be kind of upsetting, but I think pre-planning is a gift to your family.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And people think that, or they have maybe a fear of pre-planning because they think that, well, if I do that, then maybe I'll die. I'm thinking like we're all going to go. But, you know, it's just that, I don't know, superstitious thought that if they pre-plan that, you know, what if I put this in place and then I don't have it, you know, then I pass away. I'm like, no, that's not going to happen. But, you know, it's even hard for people to come into the funeral home and talk about their funeral. You know, I did the same when I first got my will. We didn't have a will. And I had a baby, or as soon as we were going to have a baby, and I went into the funeral hall, or I went into the law office with my husband, and we were both funeral directors. And the funeral director said, okay, well, who will we leave your child to if you pass away? And my husband looked over and I was crying. And so he said, Lorna, we do this every day. You know the importance of a will. And I said, I know, but when I'm actually talking about my child and who is he going to go to, you know, it's just a, I don't know. So, but I think people just need to realize the importance of that.
Well, it strikes me that in the same way that we want to avoid grief, I think we also want to avoid thinking about death. And I'm not sure if that's a trend or if that's always been the case.
I would say it's always been the case. Yeah, people don't want to talk about their own funeral. People don't even want to talk about someone else's funeral. You know, I think, you know, when my dad was ill and it came down to, we were going to be placing him into hospice. And I went in and we didn't actually know if he wanted to be buried or cremated. And my husband said, you know, we've been licensed funeral directors for 25 years. How do we not know if your dad wants to be buried or cremated? And I said, I've never talked to him about it. And he, you know, he got ill and it was fairly quick that all of a sudden we needed to make these decisions. And I had to go in like right the day before we were taking him to hospice and say, Dad, do you want to be buried or cremated? And he said, oh, whatever you guys want. You know, like he was just putting us at ease. But that was something, yeah, you just avoid talking about it. When it's about your loved one, you just don't want to bring that subject up, especially when someone's sick. So it's better to do it ahead of time. You know, it's much lighter when I make funeral prayer arrangements with someone that is healthy and well compared to someone that is imminently ill.
And that's true for the family as well, like making those decisions under stress when someone's in crisis or in yes. hospital is harder than making those decisions earlier. You know, I find in ministry, and perhaps it's because I'm removed from the family, I'm not a direct family member, but it's more than once been the case where I will have a conversation with someone who knows they are dying and they are relieved to talk openly about it. Will talk about it with them. They're afraid to make their family upset. They're right. Their family is afraid to make them upset, but they are very eager to kind of explore what it is happening to them.
Get their choices made to them or make choices known to others.
And even just express their fears and their hopes about death.
Yeah, to talk about it. And I think, when people aren't talking to the ill person about it, I think they think they're protecting the person. But as you say, it's such a relief that someone will talk to them about it.
Absolutely. So maybe sometimes there is a trusted kind of friend or somebody who's not immediate family that could help navigate, navigate those conversations. You have experienced countless families reflecting on the life of a loved one. You know, how many funerals would you say you've attended now?
Oh, I don't know if I can count. Many.
Yes. So celebrating the good in someone. And also you've seen people working through, you know, grief, and that can be complicated with disappointments and hurts. So what would you say makes for a meaningful life? That's a big question, but I wondered if you had some specific insights when it comes to the end of a person's life. You know, what matters most?
I would say for me, the most important thing is the people that you love, you hope they love you back. That's probably the most important thing. And I don't know, that those that you love most will carry on your memories and cherish you and remember you. I think that's all that matters. No material things matter at the end, which we all know that, but sometimes you don't come to terms with that. People always think about material things, but really all that matters is your family and faith at the end of life is a big thing for me as well. I think when I see families travel through grief, those without faith have a much more difficult ride, I guess, or much more difficult path than those with faith. So I would say family and faith are the most important things at the end of life.
And does that faith express itself in kind of a hope for continuation of someone's soul, or what could you say a bit more about that?
I think just knowing where someone's going, like having faith that, this is not the end, you know, the person's life is just not over and that their life had meaning. And there's also, belief for you that you're going to go where they're going at the end of your life. Yeah, absolutely. or that's what I think. And I think it gives people comfort here. Like, we've had a funeral recently, you know, of a young person. And if they have children, I think for that child to know that, you know, their parent is somewhere that is, you know, this wonderful place, I think that is much easier. No part of it is easy, but that is a much better thought than, you know, their life is over here.
Mm-hmm. And I guess in really broad terms, the sense that there's a bigger picture we can't fully see, but
Absolutely.
That we trust in a promise.
Yes. Yeah.
Lorna, what gives you hope? What keeps you going in the work that you do?
I think my hope would be, or what gives me hope is that, still the traditions in our raising our children and our future, because, you know, having four children, I sometimes worry about this next generation and what they're going to be. And I just have faith that everything will work in the, you know, God's plan will get them to the right area in their life. But I think what gives me hope is that still traditions and rituals and ceremony, for my job, I would say, I hope that those trends continue. Cause I think those trends are what keeps communities strong, families strong. Like, we need to hope that we have those rituals and ceremonies and traditions continue into our next generations. You know, I sat down to watch Prince Philip's funeral, for example, with my mom and my daughter, and I was watching it, and you know, my daughter's 17, and she had questions, like saying, you know, what is this and what is that and why are they doing this, and my son was there as well. And at the end, my husband said, "I'm just glad they sat and watched that they were interested, you know, in the ritual of it." And although it was such a low key funeral due to COVID, and I think that was Prince Philip's wish as well, but you know, just that tradition and ritual, I hope that continues for future generations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I often feel this way about Christian traditions that, and you could say this about many different faith traditions, that these are rituals that mark often times of great transition and help us navigate those transitions. And they're ancient. People have found them to be meaningful and helpful for millennia.
For hundreds and hundreds. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, and I hope they continue. I know that's all we can hope for.
So we have much to learn from them, I think. Even if we adapt them.
Yeah. They may change time to time, but I think sometimes we, you know, go backwards, or we advance, we think, but then we go back to more traditional ways. So, yeah.
It will be interesting to see how this pandemic influences those traditions, you know, which parts of it we maintain, and then maybe sometimes return to more traditional expressions of funerals because of the upheaval of this experience. Yes. I'm sure also, Lorna, that you get a lot of motivation and hope from the expressions of gratitude I have seen so many families offer you because of the important work that you do with them and the care and comfort that you provide.
Oh, yes. Yeah. It is a very rewarding that way. And I think we live in a wonderful community. I'm sure you feel that through ministry too, but we live in a wonderful community where people are so appreciative. And yeah, it does give me great, makes my heart feel good at the end of the day, knowing that you did a little bit to try and help.
You were there for people in their most difficult hour. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
Thank you for all the work that you're doing in really challenging circumstances this past year. And our community is in good hands.
Oh, and with you as well. Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Let us pray. God of all consolation and compassion, your Son comforted the grieving sisters, Martha and Mary. Your breath alone brings life to dry bones and weary souls. Pour out your Spirit upon those who grieve, those who are ill, those at the end of life. Pour out your Spirit upon caregivers and first responders, upon funeral home staff and healthcare professionals. Pour out your Spirit upon essential workers and migrant workers and all those laboring or living in circumstances that put them at a greater health risk. Pour out your Spirit on the weary and disheartened, on the hopeless and lonely, on the young and the old. Pour out your Spirit upon us all, that we may face life and death with the hope of resurrection and with faith in the one who called Lazarus forth from the grave. Amen. Thank you for listening. You can support this podcast by rating and reviewing it, sharing it with friends, donating to the church, and praying for this ministry. A special thank you to Lorna Baker for sharing her thoughts and reflections with us. Join us next time for two special podcasts with the Reverend Paul Rohde while I am off on continuing education. As you reflect on today's podcast, I pray that you have a sense that new life beckons, peace holds out its arms. Begin your week knowing that you are walking straight into the embrace of God. Amen.